Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Sachs. I'm appearing today on behalf of Barbara Trattler, the plaintiff appellant. Before addressing the primary issues relative to the exclusion of Dr. Citron's draft letter, I'd like to briefly address the argument relating to the 15-4 instruction, which was the second principal issue raised in the appeal brief. This issue concerns the pattern jury instruction found in the Colorado jury instructions at 15-4, chapter 15-4. Nearly the identical issues that are raised in this case were previously addressed in a decision of this court called Day versus Johnson. In that case, a division of the Court of Appeals upheld the instruction as an accurate statement of Colorado law. As the court is no doubt aware, the Supreme Court subsequently granted certiorari to review the Court of Appeals decision. The briefing and argument in that case has been completed, and that case stands submitted in the Supreme Court.
I take it you're not arguing that this case is any different. I mean, it's the identical issue.
It's substantially so, except to the extent that in the Day case, it didn't specifically address the first paragraph, first sentence of the 15-4 instruction. But in any case, I would submit to the court that there's no Colorado appellate rule that specifically permits the court to await the decision of the Supreme Court on a dispositive issue concerning the 15-4 instruction and whether it's an accurate statement of the law. However, I did want to point out that the courts of this state, including this court, do have inherent authority to control the disposition of cases, pending cases before the court. And suffice it to say that to the extent that this court does have the inherent authority, we would like to suggest that the court simply await the decision of the Supreme Court on this dispositive issue, because considering relevant factors such as the judicial economy of this court, it would seem to make sense for this court to wait the relatively short period of time that we think it will take for the Supreme Court to issue a decision. So,
Sachs, when was the case argued?
The case was argued in the last 2 months, I believe. I think it was in February. So there's no telling when, there's no hard and fast rule for the Supreme Court or this court for a decision to be forthcoming, but we think that considerations like judicial economy certainly weigh in favor of the court just simply awaiting a dispositive ruling of the Supreme Court on the nearly identical issues. Okay. That really is, I think, all that I have to say on the 15-4 instruction, except as to the first paragraph. I did want to mention that our appeal has specifically raised the question as to the validity of the first sentence, which reads, "A physician does not guarantee or promise a successful outcome by simply treating or agreeing to treat a patient." Now, it's actually hard to tell whether or not the decision in Day v. Johnson addressed it, because there's some language in it that does indicate that the instruction in its entirety was considered by the division. However, I think that you could also fairly read it to say that it didn't address that at all. And in fact, there was some briefing in the Supreme Court on that very issue. So to the extent that the Day v. Johnson didn't address that first paragraph, I simply want to point out to this court that the notes on use, as we pointed out to the trial court, clearly indicates that it is reserved for the rather rare case where there's a breach of contract claim or a claim that a physician has expressly or impliedly agreed to render care and to that would result in a successful outcome or a particular outcome. In this particular case, there was no claim of the sort. So that sentence that the trial court instructed in the instruction number 18 in this case served only to be confusing, and it was frankly unnecessary and inconsistent with the notes on use. So for that reason, we're asking this court to hold that it was error for the trial court to have given that first sentence instruction in 15-4.
how could that sentence have influenced the jury's verdict? I mean, you're not contending that that particular sentence is an incorrect statement of the law, are you?
No, we're not contending it's an incorrect statement of the law. We are contending that it had absolutely no bearing whatsoever in this particular case, since there was no contract or warranty theory.
Assuming that's the prejudice, what's the harm to your client?
Well, first of all, it's harmful and prejudicial to the extent that it injects an issue into the case that does not in any way relate to any evidentiary matter or factual matter before the court. It could only be confusing to the jury under the circumstances of this case. So that alone, we think, is justification for the court at least to find that it was erroneous to have given that instruction here. All right. I would like to also, I should add that my hope is to reserve about 4 minutes of time. I'm keeping track of the time, but we'll see whether or not my remarks allow me to do that. The first issue that we presented has to do with whether or not a draft letter that had been drafted by Dr. Citron before he had retained counsel, without, and which he drafted and generated without the assistance of counsel, but which, according to testimony that he rendered, was furnished to counsel, to insurance defense counsel. Incidentally, I should probably identify the lawyers. There were three lawyers that, according to the record, were consulted by Dr. Citron shortly after he had been contacted by Mr. Leventhal in writing, asking to furnish a factual account of telephone conversations he had had with the deceased, Mr. Trattler, which were not reflected in his medical records at all. So he prepared a factual account that was responsive to questions that were raised by Mr. Leventhal, who had contacted Dr. Citron on behalf of the plaintiff, Barbara Trattler, trying to obtain factual information, factual matters, that were not reflected in his medical chart. So this inquiry came after there had been a request for a copy of Dr. Citron's chart. So in response, Dr. Citron indicated through his sworn testimony during the first trial, which occurred before Judge Joe Meyer, that he was attempting to assist Mr. Leventhal with a factual investigation concerning these telephone conversations. He also testified that he prepared the letter entirely by himself. He also indicated that it was prepared without assistance. Now, at that time, there was a request for an order compelling disclosure of that letter, and it came right on the verge of the trial. And the reason for that timing was that up until that point, it was unknown to the plaintiff and to the plaintiff's counsel that this draft letter had even existed. So once it was ascertained through a disclosure that there was a fax cover sheet, but that the accompanying letter had not been disclosed, there was a request that it be produced. And then there were proceedings over whether or not it should be produced. And during the course of that testimony, there was a record made, and the record consisted of the draft letter itself, which is in a sealed exhibit that is before this court, and the testimonial evidence of Dr. Citron, which essentially, it's set forth in our brief, but essentially it's what I indicated. Now, at that point, it was incumbent on Judge Meyer to determine whether or not, as the defendants argued and contended, without the benefit of any privilege log whatsoever, whether or not this was covered by the attorney-client privilege or whether it was covered by the attorney work product doctrine. As you know, the privilege is statutory. It's covered in Section 1390.107.1b. The work product doctrine is embodied in Rule 26b3. Now, the court determined that it was both privileged and that it was also covered by the work product doctrine. However, the evidence that was presented to the court, we contend, does not support the trial court's findings as to either the attorney-client privilege or the work product doctrine.
Let me see if I understand this correctly. So you're saying that if a client or a person retains a lawyer and says, please look at this letter for me and tell me if I need to change anything in it, that's not privileged?
Your Honor.
That's what happened here.
Well, there are different accounts during the first trial and the testimony during the second trial as to what happened. And Dr. Citron himself contradicted himself during the first and second account. But putting that aside for a second, our contention is that if a client, whether it's an individual or an entity, takes purely factual matter and furnishes that factual matter to an attorney, then the facts themselves are not covered by the privilege.
But you were free to ask him about the facts. You were free to ask him, did you have more than one conversation? You did ask him all those questions. So they weren't hiding any of the facts.
Well, Your Honor, the facts were best reflected in that initial draft, which was purely factual, which Dr. Citron himself testified that he had not prepared in anticipation of litigation. He was preparing it to assist the plaintiff in carrying out an investigation here. So it was the objective of it was not to secure legal advice. It was a draft that was intended to further the plaintiff's investigation.
I'm confused. Why would somebody send a letter to counsel asking them to look it over if it wasn't in furtherance of legal advice?
Well, as Your Honor is aware, in these cases, the defendant is insured by professional malpractice insurance coverage. He took steps, and I'm not criticizing Dr. Citron for doing this, he took steps to give notice to his insurance carrier. And apparently, in so doing, the insurance carrier said, well, before you submit your reply, let's review it. So we're not asking for, and we never asked for, the content of communications between attorney and client. What we were seeking was purely factual matter. So, and our contention is that the attorney-client privilege, strictly construed as it must be in this case, does not protect purely factual matter. So,
well, you can always again ask them about the facts. But you can't ask somebody, "What facts did you tell your attorney?" That's what you're trying to do. What facts did you tell your attorney? That question's off limits.
Your Honor, the problem here is that the way this was done, it shielded factual matter, you know, which was critically important for the plaintiff's case.
So
that was the best evidence of what had happened in phone conversations between Dr. Citron and Mr. Trattler. And Mr. Trattler, of course, wasn't around to rebut Dr. Citron's account. I'd like to, could I reserve 1 minute of my time? Thank you.
May it please the court.
Hey, could you start out by addressing your opponent's suggestion that we defer issuing a decision until the Supreme Court issues its opinion on the instruction?
Oh, sure, Your Honor. Day versus Johnson was argued on March 3. We do not know when the decision will come down. It could be a month from now, 6 months from now. I am not clear when that decision will come down. As counsel has mentioned, there's no doctrine or rule that requires this court to wait till the Supreme Court's decision. In fact, I believe Judge Webb in Ochoa case did not wait for the Supreme Court's ruling on the Goodwin, the interest case, and made a decision and later revised the decision based upon subsequent Supreme Court decision. So the
question is what my choice would. This is kind of a yes or no question. Are you requesting that we issue our opinion in the ordinary course, or are you agreeing with your opponent that maybe sitting on it makes sense?
I'm asking the court to rule in ordinary course because I do not know when the Supreme Court will decide, and I believe appellant does have remedy. They could file a petition for rehearing if the decision comes down, and ask for reconsideration if they can file for petition for certiorari, but we simply don't know when the decision's coming, and I think
okay, you object, that's all we need to hear.
And this case has been going on for 9 years, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I also wanted to mention that there is another issue that's slightly different. We did make a fact harmless error argument, and I would submit that does not necessarily involve, it all depends on the facts of the case. And in this case, we're talking about two sentences in an instruction that consisted of 32 instructions. And I would submit to Your Honor, Judge Jones mentioned, I don't think that those two sentences was prejudicial. There was overwhelming evidence that Dr. Sichuan was not negligent. This case was actually tried twice, as the court knows, and both times resulted in defense verdict. The last trial, the jury deliberated for 26 minutes. And I would submit to you there was overwhelming evidence that to support the verdict. And going to the draft letter, there are multiple reasons why the trial court's decision on the draft letter should be affirmed. As an initial matter, the law of the case controls this case. In the first trial, Judge Meyer, as counsel mentioned, ruled that the draft letter was privileged. Plaintiff appealed that and lost. Plaintiff should not get a second opportunity to appeal that ruling again. Under the mandate rule, a trial court has no discretion to disregard appellate rulings. Both the holding as well as the necessary rationale must be followed on remand. And in this case, plaintiff appealed Judge Meyer's order precluding the cross-examination of Dr. Sichuan about the draft letter. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed Judge Meyer's ruling, quote, because the letter was drafted after Dr. Sichuan obtained insurance counsel to represent him, plaintiff's inquiries would have invaded attorney-client privilege. Because the Court of Appeals found that the draft letter is protected by the attorney-client privilege, that ruling must be followed on remand.
Notwithstanding,
I think they are incorrect that reversal on other grounds means that the portion of the court's ruling that was not addressed by the Supreme Court can be ignored.
Are you aware of any Colorado case that expressly turns on the question of what happens to other rulings in a trial if the Supreme Court reverses on a different ground and demands a new trial?
We cited to two cases, Your Honor. Ryder versus Mitchell, 54 P3rd, 885, pages 893, Colorado Supreme Court, 2002. And it said, the Court of Appeals judgment reversing and remanding the attorney fee order stands despite reversal on different grounds. In that case, I believe they found no duty, but the attorney fee award that remained intact. And there was another case, Fair versus Red Lions Inn, and it's in the footnote one, the way I cited it for us, where Supreme Court did not address the Court of Appeals affirmance of judgment on the breach of contract theory, that in conclusion, and I'm quoting, remains the law of the case, will not be disturbed by our review. And that's what the Supreme Court said. And we cited to some 10th Circuit case in other jurisdiction. And the general proposition, as I understand it, is when a party fails to challenge the Court of Appeals ruling, or that ruling is accepted as the law of the case. And in this case, they filed a petition for certiorari on the trial court's order striking two of their experts. And I'm sure the court is well aware of it. And did not petition the Supreme Court to review this court's ruling on the draft letter. And I would submit on because of that, that Court of Appeals ruling is the law of the case and should be followed.
Jian, assuming that the trial court was obligated to follow that earlier ruling, it doesn't follow that we are. It doesn't follow that we're obligated to follow the division's prior ruling. And we can revisit that under the law of the case doctrine, can't we? We're not bound by what the prior division said, in other words. Trial court might be, but we're not.
As a general matter, another division's court decision is not binding on this court. But I think in this case, what we're talking about is a situation where plaintiff appealed that ruling, and the Court of Appeals ruled. They didn't appeal that ruling further. And then I believe it becomes the law of the case which controls, because they exhausted their appeal. And I don't think on remand, the trial court is supposed to follow in. I think this court is just supposed to see if they actually follow the mandate of the earlier court's ruling. I think that's the question before this court.
So you're in effect saying that we are bound by the prior decision. I'm not aware of any case that says we are. I mean, it seems to me under the law of the case doctrine, the same court can revisit its own rulings at any time. It doesn't have to follow its own earlier ruling.
Well, let's say in the Hardesty case, which was cited, in that case, the Court of Appeals issued a ruling on an issue, and then it got remanded, and I believe the trial court said that is the law of the case. The issue before the Court of Appeals the second time was, did the trial court follow the law of the case as previously announced?
Right, that's one issue. Did the trial court have an obligation to follow
the mandate?
That's one issue, but there's a separate issue. Are we obligated? And I don't see any case law that says that we, as the same court that decided the issue in the first place, is obligated to follow our prior ruling.
I would agree that general matter, you don't, but I think when you're just applying the law of the case, the only narrow question before this court, I think, is did they apply it correctly? In my opinion, I think that's the only question before this court. But even if the court were to reconsider that ruling, I would submit to you it was correct. And I could go through the attorney-client privilege argument, and the attorney-client privilege doesn't only protect information and communication that an attorney had with the client. It also protects information and communication the client conveys to the attorney so that the attorney could give sound legal advice. And most courts have found that even when the final product is disclosed to the public, the underlying privilege attaches to the drafts of the final of the draft, because it was sent to the client to get legal advice. In this case, I would disagree with counsel, and I believe Judge Myers' findings would support bear this out. And he found that what happened was plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Leventhal, sent a letter to Dr. Citron. This is the second letter after asking for his records, asked him for a detailed conversation, a telephone conversation that Dr. Citron had with Mr. Trattler. And Dr. Citron contacted his malpractice carrier immediately. Counsel was immediately retained for Dr. Citron. And Dr. Citron specifically sent that letter to obtain, as Judge Jones mentioned, for the purpose of obtaining legal advice and how to respond to Mr. Leventhal's letter. Therefore, the draft letter, which wasn't disclosed to anybody other than counsel and for the Judge Meyer for in-camera review, was confidential communication by a client in the course of obtaining legal advice. And plaintiff is mistaken that Dr. Citron is using the attorney-client privilege as a shield to protect the factual information. That's not true. As Judge Jones pointed out, Dr. Citron has never refused to disclose the content of the telephone call with Mr. Traylor. He testified under oath in deposition in two trials about the content of the telephone call. Plaintiff's counsel vigorously cross-examined him about the content of the phone call, including in the second trial, the fact that he received assistance from counsel in preparing a response to that letter. And the court even instructed at the request of the plaintiff that the jury could consider the fact that the final draft of the letter may have been affected by the consultation with others in deciding what weight to give the version of events contained in that letter. So I would submit, while Dr. Citron may be compelled to testify about the telephone call, he is not required to reveal what he told his lawyer about the telephone call.
In your brief, you make an alternative harmless error argument, yes, by pointing to Judge Meyer's, I don't know if it was a finding or if it was more just a comment, that there's no substantive difference between the two letters. Here's my question. Are you asking us as an appellate court to examine the letter that was sent and the draft that's in the record under seal and make a judgment and turn our decision on the basis that the letters either are or are not substantially the same?
No, we're not.
Okay, thank you.
But I just wanted to point out, Judge Meyer didn't just make comment. He heard argument. I think it's in volume 25. The court will read. There was argument by Mr. Leventhal, argument by Ms. Moran, who was counsel in the court below. And then Judge Myers made specific findings, and I believe it's 1703 to 1706, going through all of the letters and finding that there were no substantive differences. And he said there's nothing in the way of smoking gun. And based on those findings, I believe that it would not affect the decision as a harmless error.
Well, doesn't that beg the question? Correct. Now, looking at the letter, how do we know the judge was correct?
You're right, but the Supreme Court in the Trujillo case warned that I believe what the court said was that frequent and often in-camera review is not always warranted, and that the court should be hesitant to frequently review privileged files. And the court said that it has chilling effect if frequently easily done on lawyers and frank communication between lawyers and clients. So
the trial court here did
bear that in mind.
The trial court here did an in-camera review.
Yes, Judge Meyer did, and that's why we object to frequent and continuous review of the record. That's what I'm saying, and he made specific findings to support it. And I believe that ruling should be reviewed just for abuse of discretion.
How can we decide if he abused his discretion if we can't look at the letter?
Well, my first
question, he makes a factual finding about what the letter says, and you're saying, but don't look at the letter to decide whether that's right? That's pretty much impossible.
I would agree with you, but our first argument was within the context, that there's within the context of how this letter was prepared, that there's attorney-client, regardless of what the content is, it's protected by the attorney-client privilege, and therefore that ends the inquiry. But if the court is to go through and do the harmless error analysis, I would agree with you that it would be difficult. But I think you have to keep in mind, do we even have to go there to do that because of the Supreme Court's warning in the Trujillo case?
I understand your position. You're asking us to look at the abuse of discretion in the privilege ruling first and only get to the harmless error if we have concerns over the privilege ruling.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's the alternative argument. Thank you.
We
contend that the court has got to review the entire record, which also includes the sealed exhibit.
You want us to do that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and if we do that and conclude that the records, the two letters, are substantially the same with respect, isn't that the end of your privilege arguments?
Well, it depends on how you construe Judge Meyer's findings, because...
Well, we're not construing Judge Meyer's findings. You're wanting us to look at the two letters and come to a conclusion. Since they're written documents, you'd agree that's a de novo review, right?
Does it support the findings made by Judge Meyer?
Okay, and if we conclude there's no substantive difference between the two letters, isn't that the end of your privilege
argument? That is the end of the privilege argument. Unless this is outside the scope of the privilege or the privilege has been waived.
What difference would it make
if the letters have no substantive difference?
Well, I would, may I?
Sure.
Just to complete the answer. Judge Meyer also specifically pointed out that there were discrepancies, and he had no doubt that Mr. Leventhal could make use of those discrepancies on cross-examination effectively.
Did you make such a
final? It's in Judge Meyer's initial findings.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion. When we do that, it will be the subject of discussion among the judges.